Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
We're going to visit with Marvin and Mark Sussman. Marv was 75 years ago, I understand it, at H hour, actually before the very first troops landed at Normandy, he was being deployed with a group. And I want to talk about that in like 30 seconds. But first, let's start with Mark Sussman, who is his son. Mark, thanks for coming into the studio. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for having us.
So you are a real estate agent or developer in town?
Yes, I am.
A friend of, a mutual acquaintance of ours, a friend of yours, told me about you and your dad. So you're born and raised in Chicago, too?
Yes.
And the man sitting next to you is Marvin. Marvin, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you.
If I may, how old are you then?
I'll be 96 in August.
How old were you on D-Day?
Almost 21.
You know, I've been seeing stories every now and then in documentaries about D-Day because the 75th anniversary is coming up. In fact, I'm going to be with a group of our listeners there, courtesy of the folks from Kelly Cruises, in August. So right after the anniversary of D-Day, we'll be there. And the selling point, if you will, has been on the 75-year anniversary of D-Day, you'll be able to be on the beaches of Normandy.
Yeah.
You were on the beaches of Normandy, June of 1944. But you were there before the main assault landed, right?
Yeah, 2 hours before.
2 hours before. What were you doing 2 hours before?
We were landing on an island about 5 kilometers off Utah Beach with the intent to find out if the naval guns were manned or unmanned. Turned out that they were unmanned, but somebody had to verify that. And with the result is that due to mines, explosive mines on the beach, we lost 2 men killed and about 20 wounded.
How many were in your group?
Oh, 2 troops would have been almost 300 men.
So 300 men land on this little island that I haven't heard about to make sure that this gun gets taken out in case it's going to rain on the troops as they come in.
Well, if we found that it was manned, then we would signal an infantry assault group and then airplanes and everything else that would take care of that naval thing.
When you got there, you must have been relieved to find out that the gun was unmanned.
Yeah, and saddened by the death of dear friends.
The two that were killed by the mines.
Right.
And then from that vantage point, that day on D-Day then, you must have seen or been able to hear what was happening.
We were watching the parade. It was magnificent thing, all those ships going by us, but no cameras. No, we had. All we have is the memory.
And what do you remember about that? Because if I may, did you think this parade is an awesome display of power, but you must have had some sense of how vicious the fighting was?
Well, we couldn't really see much on the beach for 5 kilometers, but we could see the explosions, we could see the airplanes and the naval guns going off, and we could just imagine what was going on the beaches.
I suppose the guys that were in the first waves must have felt like they got the short straw, right? Because, you know, they had to just keep charging and they were the first ones up.
Yeah, they were thinking about where to go, what to do. That's what they were thinking about.
And you must have felt a little fortunate to have had the assignment you did. What are the chances?
Well, we lucked out. It could have been worse.
So you were living in Chicago. Did you get drafted then? Is that what called you up?
No, we were given the choice of either volunteering during 1943, or 1942, or be drafted in 1943. So rather than be drafted into the infantry in 43, I decided to join the cavalry in 42. Nobody told me that when the cavalry dismounts, it becomes infantry.
So the cavalry sounded like a safer bet, but
no,
maybe not.
I was entirely wrong about that.
What does cavalry mean in 1943?
Cavalry was just then trading in its horses for jeeps and armored cars, and the job of cavalry is really information, mostly finding out where the enemy is, what he's doing, and doing whatever's necessary to stop him.
It's interesting you mention that, because when you do look at old pictures of especially the first part of World War II, you will see on both sides horses. Pulling cannons or propelling troops, whatever. Obviously, it was motorized and mechanized, but the horses were still involved.
They were in World War One, but cavalry was unimportant in World War One because it was trench warfare. So cavalry, the horses were used for motive power. And during World War Two, of course, the United States Army had no horses, but the German Army, we had a lot of horses, because other than their motorized divisions, of which they had a dozen or so, all the other divisions were horse-pulled.
Did they tell you all what to expect when the D-Day landing forces were going to arrive in Normandy?
Well, we knew our assignment maybe a day before. Until then, we knew nothing.
Really?
We were totally mystified about what we were going to do.
Well, I'm wondering if you had a sense of what the resistance would be, not on your island per se, but on the beaches.
Well, they tried to tell us about the kind of fortifications we were going to find, but nobody could give us detailed information.
I guess it wouldn't have been all that helpful anyway. If you knew that there were these embankments and you were going to have to overtake them, you'd have to storm the beach, sometimes climb. You'd do that, but telling you the volume of lead coming back at you might not have been all that helpful.
Nobody had enough information. No. And, of course, they were wrong about where to land the paratroopers, and war is one big mistake. That's what it is.
Looking at your son now, and you know some of his stories better than I do, so feel free to chime in with additional information or questions here. But then when it was determined that that island was not occupied by the Germans, so that gun isn't an issue, and there's a few hundred of you on that island, then a landing craft eventually came back and got you all, right?
They got us off, and they took us to Utah Beach, which was then a safe place. And since we had none of our vehicles or heavy armament, because all our machine guns were mounted on our jeeps and armored cars, we were all mobile, entirely mobile, we had to wait for delivery of our automotive equipment. So for about a week, our assignment was to guard headquarters, the Army Corps headquarters, where General Collins was installed.
They established that on the beach or nearby?
Yeah, pretty close, the next day or two. And so we had a lot of KP duty and messenger duty and guard duty and until our weapons came. And then we were off running.
Well, I guess you would see plenty of action eventually.
Oh, yes, yes.
Before I get to that, though, say in those first hours or those first few days then, where you weren't so intimately involved in the shooting, were you anxious to get involved, or each day that you weren't, were you happy not to be?
Well, that's both.
Yeah, both. A perfect answer, I suppose.
Yeah, both. Because it was just a matter of time before we got involved. And by time, I mean days, not months or weeks.
When you did get to, what beach then were you eventually landcrafted onto?
Utah Beach.
What did you see when you came upon that scene?
Well, Utah Beach was not as difficult as Omaha Beach. There was some debris, and I guess it had been cleaned up by the time we got there. It was very safe. So we didn't get involved in the war until about a week later.
And then what happened? So what happened?
Well,
to you then?
Our job then was to what we call screen the flank of the 4th Infantry Division. We would follow them and stay on their flanks to prevent a surprise. We warn them and pick up stragglers and do whatever is necessary. And we did this, a lot of that dismounted with rifles rather than running around with jeeps. Foot patrols, just poking around, finding out what's going on. And we did that across the peninsula to the other side, which took almost a month.
What was that like?
Well, it was, say, interesting.
Did you? In some ways, you'd say maybe better. You can tell I'm in survival mode right here.
Yeah.
And maybe that's not appropriate to what you were asked to do. But I wonder if on the perimeter then you felt like that was an advantageous position for yourself, or did you feel really vulnerable because you're stuck out there on the wing?
Well, we were sure vulnerable, and we did run into Germans, but we never had a fixed battle. It was patrols meeting patrols, firing at them and being fired at them, but and there were incidents. Now, I've written several stories about this, and I've gone on YouTube, and you can find me on YouTube telling these stories on the way to the other side of the peninsula. Yeah.
Marvin Sussman is here. He's a Chicagoan who's 96 years old, right? Did I age you?
Almost.
Almost 96. He was almost 21 on D-Day. He was there 2 hours before everybody else landed to secure an island just off the beaches. And he tells the story on YouTube. And as D-Day is approaching the 75th anniversary, a friend or a mutual acquaintance told me a little bit about you, and we asked you to come in. You're actually going back over to France in the near future, are you not?
On D-Day, this year, we should be on the beach, yeah.
How many, I wonder, if it was a reunion of those of you that were there that first day and first week, I wonder how many there would be.
Well, it's interesting. The 50th anniversary, 1994, there were 40,000 D-Day veterans showed up on the beach. And 5 years later, the 55th anniversary, 1999, there were 4,000. Not 40, but we lost a zero. And 5 years later, there was 400. So this time, maybe 40.
You really are one of the great stories and storytellers of World War II, then, aren't you?
Yeah, well, the story I tell is about a couple of them are in Normandy, and one of them in the other battlefields. But we were given infantry assignments, dismounted, cleaning up the peninsula, working toward the Atlantic coast, toward Cherbourg. And we captured a lot of Germans. Growing up in a Jewish home, I had learned Yiddish, which is a dialect of German. So I was the German interpreter. And having studied French in England by phonograph record for about 6 months before the invasion, I was also the French interpreter. And so I handled prisoners. I dealt with civilians, civilians.
If I may, was your job there more personal because you were Jewish?
No, I would... I wouldn't say that. It was just an accident that I knew German, because I had 2 years of German in high school, plus a Yiddish background.
Right.
I had 2 years of Latin in high school, and lived in an Italian neighborhood, so French was easy for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it came in handy. And it's interesting that I was one of the few guys, 140 men in a cavalry troop, and maybe five of us or half a dozen came from cities. The others were rural kids growing up on farms or small towns, and they knew everything. Kid born on a farm can fix anything.
Knows how to survive in the woods, knows how to get through.
Yeah, I was useless as nipples on a bull, my sergeant said. but when they found out I knew French and German, well...
Right place, right time.
I became useful.
So when you tell stories, what's the story you like to tell, or what's one of your tales that you tell?
Well, I tell a story about... the time we got we ambushed a German company, the remains of a German company, and killed their leader, and that's one story. Another story is how they tried to send me to West Point, but it didn't work out.
And you weren't officer material.
I it turned out that I had a very high score in an aptitude test that everybody gets, and with 30 days of combat experience and that score, I was the only man in the squadron who qualified. Huh. But I wore glasses, so they ruled me out. So that otherwise.
Marvin Sussman's here. Mark, when your dad tells these stories, I guess, did you grow up hearing them as well?
Well, no, actually. My father didn't say much about this. I have to tell you, until 1994, when he went to that reunion and we found out that he went to it, I really had little understanding of my father's war experience.
We found out that he went to it. He didn't tell you he was going to the reunion?
My mom and dad were spending summers in France at that point. My mother was born and raised there, and they moved to her childhood home summers. And so what they did on their summer vacation, we didn't really know.
So this second chapter of your dad's life is a bit of a revelation to you then, huh?
Well, to all of us it was.
And what surprised you about his story in World War II?
Well, I think that every child doesn't know that their parents had a real life before them. And as time has gone by and we've gained my brothers and I and our family have gained a better understanding of, you know, how pivotal and existential the threat was in World War II, and, you know, what this group of people did. You know, 16 million men in the armed forces during World War II. It's staggering.
Fighting with what, a rifle? What kind of gun did you have?
Well, we rode around in jeeps. When once we broke out of Normandy, the cavalry went out in front, leading the way, and open roads, and the point jeep, the first jeep, going down an empty road. It would be two jeeps and an armored car and a squad, and we had three 50 caliber machine guns, one on each vehicle, three 30 caliber machine guns on each vehicle, and the armored car. It was two jeeps and an armored car. The armored car had a 37 millimeter cannon that could shoot white phosphorus.
Yeah.
So we had. We could dispatch 100 bullets in 3 seconds if we all shot at the same time. And so we were armed, better than the Germans were.
Was there a point maybe early on in your tour in Europe where it was shoot or be shot, where this was
absolutely.
But my point is, was that... that must have been a new feeling, right? I mean, were trained as an engineer, going to be in Chicago someday, and now you're this kid thrown into France. You haven't shot or killed anybody before, and now you're about to do it. I wonder what that moment is like for a young man.
It would be entirely new for me because of the 140 men in the troop. I was probably maybe a half a dozen of us from the city. had never done hunting from age 10 like the other guys. And the idea of just shooting a rifle at something was new, entirely new. So it was just unexpected, but we were trained to do it. We had good training.
You know, I just finished the book I told your son, Spearhead, which is about a World War II, a U.S. World War II, actually the Germans as well, but it was about what the tank battles were like, what those tankers, they called them, the men in the tanks, what the life of those tankers was like, and what, you know, just how difficult for us to imagine that experience would be. And afterwards, when they were in their 70s or 80s, some of those men were still dealing with the trauma of having to do that. And going back to the scene of the battles in Germany and France was very therapeutic for them. A long way of asking the question, was it difficult for you when you came back stateside to get over what all you went through in Europe?
Probably, in retrospect, yes. Although maybe at the time I was simply lost and didn't understand why. But it took me until 1949, that is 4 years after I came home, before I resolved to become an engineer and entered the Illinois Institute of Technology. I was lost for 4 years. Of course, I had gone to Roosevelt University, and I had ate lunch with Harold Washington at Roosevelt College.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was lost. I was studying languages and Russian and Italian.
Lost, okay. You were a student, though. You were going to school.
But no direction.
No direction. And maybe no even... To me, that would be the least of my concerns. I know kids going to school now, they don't know what up from down is or what they should be doing with their lives. But you seem to be now, and maybe then you were emotionally, mentally pretty stable after all of that.
I don't think so. Looking back, no.
Yeah.
No, because if I had been rational, I would have done entirely different things.
We're almost out of time, and I know you do YouTube videos, you talk to organizations and schools, which is just amazing. Any last observations or words you have for our listeners right now?
I am very much concerned about the way the world is going. I think America should have kept the draft. That was the greatest thing, because I could have never met the guys that I met without the draft. And it's a serious loss to not have the draft. We don't know. We're separated. We're isolated. We don't know other Americans. We can't know them. And the draft would have avoided that. I'm very sorry about that. And so somebody ought to do something about that. A year or two isn't that much out of somebody's life.
Is that it, though? It's not just that you'd meet other Americans, but it would be service to your country.
Service of learning what you learn in the Army, plus you can do all kinds of learning in the Army. There's a lot to learn.
So I wonder how your son feels about that. Were you in the military at any point?
No, I wasn't. I grew up in the gap between Vietnam and whatever came later.
Yeah. See, I don't know. I'm probably older than you, but as a young boy, Vietnam was being waged, and there I am, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, and I'm getting closer and closer to a draftable age, and it terrified me. I mean, as an adult today, I still think I knew kids whose brothers were going to get drafted or were in the Army, and I just could not comprehend having to do what those men were doing or what you did, sir. And even that left an impression on me all these years later, right? So I think, you know, what you did and what you're asking people to consider today is is not only commendable, but is very challenging. That's not something I expected you to say.
There's something wrong with this country, and that's why we've got the president we've got. And
we don't have to go there. Well, that's another show.
Invite me back.
You know what? I will. And we won't even talk about that. But Marvin, congratulations. Thank you for your service. Good Lord. And congratulations on living such a long, healthy, and evidently amiable life. I'm anxious for you to go back to France on the 75th anniversary.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. Yes.
Marvin, thank you for Sussman. And Mark, thank you both for coming in. Will you bring him back again sometime?
You call, we'll come.
How do people watch his videos, by the way?
You go to YouTube and search Marvin Sussman.
I love this guy. I got a 95-year-old telling me how to do YouTube. So this is this is instructive. Fellas, thanks for coming by.
You're welcome.
All right.